Deadline's the Taliban reported to capture two more provincial capitals in Afghanistan as heavy fighting rages on between the army and the militants. The top Iranian military commander says Iraqi resistance not only weakened the U.S. military in Iraq, but also incurred a huge deployment cost. And thousands of people flee their homes on the Greek island of Evia as wildfires blaze for the sixth day across parts of the country. Our top story for this half hour, the Taliban have taken over a fourth provincial capital in Afghanistan in 2 days as the group is pressing ahead with an offensive to overrun the country. The capture of Saripur in the north happened hours after the fall of Kunduz in the northeast. Local officials say all other parts of the city are now under Taliban control. The militants have also taken two other provincial capitals, Zaranj and Shebergan. The loss of provincial capitals is seen as a major blow to the Afghan government. The militant group has also seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks and are now battling for several key cities. The Taliban have intensified their offensive following the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. Well, we're going to look deeper into the events in Afghanistan now as we're joined by our correspondent Amin Alami, who's with us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Also joining us from Yekaterinburg is author and researcher Greg Simons. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Amin in Kabul. I mean, the Taliban have now taken over a fourth provincial capital in Afghanistan as the group is pressing ahead with its offensive to overrun the country. What details do you have to share with us about the recent developments?
Defense Ministry here in Kabul confirmed that the most parts of Saripur and Kunduz cities, the provincial capitals of Saripur and Kunduz provinces in northern Afghanistan, are currently under the control of the Taliban, and Afghan forces are strongly resisting against the rising Taliban attacks across these two main cities in northern Afghanistan. However, the Taliban militant group says that they have captured the entire city of Shebergan, as well as the city of Saripur and Kunduz, and they are pushing back the Afghan security forces from the remained areas in the provincial capitals across this part of Afghanistan and northern part of the country. However, military commanders on the ground also say that intense fightings are underway between Afghan forces and Taliban, especially in different parts of Kunduz, the capital city of Kunduz province in Afghanistan that connects this province to some Central Asian countries like Tajikistan. However, the collapse of Kunduz and Saripur take place while the Taliban militants had already captured Shebergan, the capital city of Juzjan province in northern Afghanistan. The back-to-back fall of these three provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan can be considered as a bad news for the Afghan government. But in the meantime, Afghan military sources, particularly Afghanistan's defense ministry, say that Afghan armed troops backed by local armed forces are planning to conduct a large-scale attack on the captured areas by the Taliban to retake them from the Taliban. But according to them, and particularly according to the military commanders on the ground, accomplishing such mission needs more time.
Let's cross over now to Greg Simons in Yekaterinburg. Mr. Simons, give us your thoughts on how events are transpiring in Afghanistan right now, and also what do you think are the proper measures and responses right now that Kabul can take to halt the offensive that is kick-started by the Taliban?
This situation has been not just a product of these current times, but it's been a result of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan for some decades. And what has happened is that the U.S. Was concentrating on supplying its proxies and its local Afghan forces with weapons, and giving them some basic training, but it absolutely neglected the psychological and cognitive elements of giving those soldiers the will to fight and use it, which the Afghan Taliban, well, they do have the will and the belief in their political and military leadership, and these current victories are just consolidating this belief. And conversely, this lack of will to fight, or apparent lack of will to fight by the Afghan forces, is going to be reinforced as well. So you've got these different negative forces which are going to be very hard to turn around. And, well, the Americans are going to be rather reluctant to get back in the ground and re-engage in one of their endless wars, which has been very poorly conceived from the very beginning.
So basically, when we're talking about the U.S. Forces and foreign forces' presence and occupation for over two decades in Afghanistan, that ultimately achieved nothing. Would you agree?
Well, absolutely. Well, it's not only achieved nothing, it's killed a lot of civilians over the years, and it's drained a lot of their blood and treasure from the US and the West. So, I mean, nothing good has come out of it. When they had a chance to withdraw, which they did not take. I mean, it's a similar situation which happened in Iraq. I mean, this desire to have these rather friendly client governments, it just doesn't work, especially in a place like Afghanistan.
Simons, one last question, Mr. Simons. The situation, how it's unfolding right now, as we're seeing cities and provinces falling to the rapid offensive of the Taliban, do you think that maybe in the near future the United States and its allies will see this as another pretext to get back in the mix in Afghanistan?
It would be a very problematic one because, okay, they might want to shore up a client state, one which will probably fall without their assistance. However, they have engaged in heightening conflict and tensions with Russia, China, and Iran. So the last thing they need is to get their forces engaged in a quite remote conflict, which doesn't serve their interests when their military strength is coming under pressure, and they need them elsewhere for more strategic conflicts, which might or might not emerge.
All right, thanks a lot. We're going to leave it there. Author and researcher Greg Simons joining us from Yekaterinburg. Also, thanks to our correspondent we spoke to earlier, Amin Alami, joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Moving on, a top Iranian military commander says a great part of the United States' decline on the world stage took place in Iraq. Major General Hossein Salami made the remarks at a meeting with Faleh al-Fayyaz, the head of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units. He underlined that Iraq's resistance not only weakened U.S. military in that country, but also incurred a huge deployment cost. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps noted that the real political power is the one which makes its presence felt in action. He praised the PMU for its defensive capabilities, internal unity, and lofty ideals. He said the Iraqi parliament's ratification on the U.S. troop pullout was aimed at making the country independent and strong, as well as moving forward without the presence of occupiers. The PMU commander, in turn, expressed his gratitude to the IRGC for its assistance in countering the occupiers. Iran slams a U.S. nuclear attack on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on the 76th anniversary of the bombardment, saying the event is a reminder of Washington's great crime against humanity. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said the tragedy shows that the United States spares no effort to reach its illegal objectives. He described nuclear weapons as a constant threat to global peace. Khatibzadeh questioned the U.S. commitment to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and nuclear disarmament. He said Washington has not only failed to take any practical step in this regard, but has also been increasingly modernizing its nuclear arsenals. Around 140,000 people died when the United States dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, before dropping a second bomb on Nagasaki 3 days later. Political commentator Jason Onua says the U.S. is the most irresponsible holder of nuclear weapons, as it's the only country that actually used them against civilians and continues to operate and upgrade them.
I don't recall the United States ever making even a single step towards the denuclearization of the country. While they've talked many years, even some past U.S. presidents have said about the inhuman nature of nuclear weapons and that it would be better if there was a world in which nuclear weapons didn't exist, which I agree, it would be a better world, but it's not something that the United States has ever worked towards. In fact, the United States has been the most irresponsible country in the world when it comes to the use of nuclear arms, as they are the only ones that have used it against a civilian population. They're also primarily responsible for the sale of nuclear weapons, or probably the procurement of nuclear weapons by South Africa, who then gave them to Israel, who continued to, in a very underhanded way, threaten other countries inside the Middle East who do not wish to accept the genocide of the Palestinians or the fulfillment of the interests of the U.S. and Israel in general. These weapons still continue to proliferate, and they still continue to be upgraded and renewed by the United States every time. I mean, they pushed very much for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which sought only to prevent countries which didn't have nuclear weapons from never getting a hold of them in the future, particularly with regards to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. In other words, to stop an arms race by preventing anybody who couldn't already compete with them to some degree.
Hezbollah chief Said Hassan Nasrallah has pledged an appropriate response to any Israeli attack. The Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement noted that Hezbollah needed to quickly respond to the Israeli attack of Lebanese lands on August the 5th in order to maintain the deterrence power. And Mariam Saleh has more in this report.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said that the recent Israeli attack was a very dangerous development, which has not occurred in the last 15 years, stressing that the resistance needed to respond swiftly.
Our response was linked directly to the two incidents of Israeli Air Force attacks, which targeted Lebanese territory for the first time in 15 years. And our response had very clear tools and objectives. We calculated our moves very precisely. Our enemy and our friends said this. They said open territory. They did not target civilians. So we also targeted open areas with no civilians. But we had many options. We could hit open areas in Sheba Farms, in northern occupied Palestine, or the occupied Golan Heights.
Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a televised speech to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war. He said that Israel deliberately targeted open areas in the middle of the night in order to terrorize civilians, and presumed that the resistance would not respond because of the various domestic problems inside Lebanon. Said Nasrallah stressed that the main deterrence for Israel is the capabilities of the resistance.
The enemy today is more fearful than any time in the past because of the developments in Palestine and the region and the transformations in the region and the ascending strength of the resistance and because of the deep internal divisions and the mutual hatred between the occupying Zionist groups. Facing their internal issues and the strengthening of the resistance, everyone in the Zionist entity is talking about an existential threat.
Experts believe the military potential of Hezbollah has created a balance of deterrence where Israel is incapable of even starting a war.
Israel wants Hezbollah to start the war. That situation will be different. Hezbollah is aware of this, will not Israel let him go to war, you know, anytime Israel wanted.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance noted that in any future confrontation, the Israeli military will disintegrate completely and would be heavily defeated. The 2006 war had settled a certain status quo, which remains until today, with a new regional equation, which comprises all the resistance groups in the region. Any miscalculation by the Israelis could be detrimental for Israel. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Political commentator Karim Sharara says if Hezbollah had not responded in time to Israel's latest attack, the operation would have lost all sense of meaning.
As for this retaliation, this was a time-sensitive operation, because if they had not retaliated, then the operation would have lost all sense, and the resistance would not have been able to make the impact that it made today. The Israeli media, I mean, some commentators, they got the idea that because the two groups that performed this retaliation were named after the two martyrs, that by this operation or by this retaliation, then Hezbollah would have actually taken vengeance, so to speak, against these for the Israeli attacks. No, this is not it, as Sayed Hassan stated. That score has not been settled yet. This is merely a retaliation against the airstrikes, but naming the two groups after these two martyrs was just to keep their memory alive and to remind the Israelis that we have not forgotten about these two martyrs, and we will retaliate as soon as the opportune moment comes.
Thousands of people have fled their homes on the Greek island of Evia as wildfires rage there and other parts of the country for the sixth straight day. The blaze on the island east of the capital Athens has so far devoured thousands of hectares of forest and forced evacuation of dozens of villages. The army has so far evacuated 2,000 residents, and ferries are on standby to evacuate more people. Wildfires initially also threatened the northern suburbs of Athens, but the flames have somewhat died back in recent days. Fires have broken out across Greece during a week-long heat wave, which is being described as the worst in three decades. Vast areas of forest land and dozens of homes and businesses have so far been destroyed by the flames. Well, that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Whenever we involve the people and whenever we made Islam the standard and the main criterion, we moved forward. However, whenever one of these two pillars became shaky, we screeched to a halt. For instance, we should bring the people to the arena of economic matters. I have been repeating for many years that small and middle-sized industrial centers should be developed and expanded. This is due to the fact that these small and middle-sized centers feed millions of people. Millions of people depend on them. This is synonymous with popular presence. If we had strengthened these centers, we would be in a better economic situation now. The same is true of various others matters. If it really becomes common for the honorable officials of the country to both pay attention to Islamic matters, in other words, to observe Islamic rules in their entirety, whether on domestic, foreign, economic, cultural, political, and various other matters, and also to ensure the people's participation, meaning that they should prepare the ground for the people to show their presence and express their demands, all the problems of the country will be resolved. Kind of Islam that Imam wanted. Well, this was the main issue. Imam's statements are important in this respect. He has made astonishing comments. I have written down a short sentence from among his statements. Imam has clear, firm, and solid statements both about Islam and about democracy. As for Islam, he decisively rejected reactionary and eclectic Islam. On the one hand, he rejected the reactionaries, and on the other hand, he rejected the eclecticists, those who feed their audience and society with the ideas put forward by others, doing so in the name of Islam. Imam decisively rejected them.
Protests in Cuba have rocked international headlines for several weeks now. It's said that they began on July 11, 2021 and have spread all across the Caribbean island into several dozens of cities. Now, the United States has not only welcomed these protests but encouraged them too. U.S. President Joe Biden not only kept former President Donald Trump's maximum pressure campaign on the Caribbean nation but increased sanctions, saying that this is just the beginning. Several prominent lawmakers in Congress, specifically in the Republican Party, have advocated direct intervention in Cuba, even suggesting airstrikes. Now, Cuba has responded that the entire affair is orchestrated by the United States in order to interfere in Cuba's internal politics. And they point to decades of covert and overt assaults on Cuba. They point to the embargo, and they point to the United States' efforts to malign the Caribbean nation. Several other presidents in the region expressed their support. President Maduro of Venezuela, President Obrador of Mexico, both raised concern that the United States should not be using humanitarian endeavors as a shield or a pretext in order to interfere in Cuba's internal affairs. So what is happening in Cuba? In order to find out, I went to get the other side of the story that you don't hear in corporate and mainstream media. I sat down with the chargé d'affaires of the Cuban embassy and permanent mission to the United Nations in Vienna. We talked extensively about these protests, the embargo, and much more. I'm Richard Medhurst.
And this is The Communique.
Marlene Rodendo, the chargé d'affaires here at the Cuban embassy in Vienna. Thanks for taking the time to receive us. I want to talk about what's happening in Cuba. You know, there are a lot of questions that people have
What is happening in Cuba? What are these protests that are taking place there? What's the real size of these protests? Could you tell us more about what the situation actually is there?
First of all, I would like to thank you for inviting me to your program to do this interview, because I think this is very important, because there has been a very huge disinformation campaign against Cuba. The projection of the media on the situation in Cuba has been very far from reality, even here in Vienna and in other medias in Europe. And to answer your first question regarding the real size of the protest and what is going on in Cuba right now, I first of all have to talk about what happened previously. The fact is that previous weeks it was developed a manipulation and communication campaign financed by the U.S. with the objective of inciting, encouraging people to go out to the streets with the objective of encouraging instability in the country. And they took the opportunity, the advantage of the real hard situation that Cuba is living right now due to the pandemic, due to the reinforcement of the blockade, with the application of more than 240 measures during the Trump administration. And they took that advantage to do their campaign. And during those weeks, they were inciting to violence. They were calling for vandalism acts. They were calling for assaulting the officials of Cuba. They were calling also for sabotage. And as a result, on July 11, vandals went out to the streets, announcing death for communists, breaking glass, throwing stones, making acts of vandalism. Of course, there is also known that a group of dissatisfied people also joined these disorders. Dissatisfied because they have been experiencing a very hard situation in Cuba in the recent month due to several causes. Due to the electro-energetic situation that was having problems during those days. Unfortunately, that problem is already solved in Cuba. But another group of accumulated problems, especially as a result of the blockade. Yeah. And unfortunately, the media have took advantage of that. And they have put a reality of Cuba that it is not. They have over dimension and intentionally exaggerated the size of the protest. And I want also to clarify that in Cuba there was not a social outbreak, as someone has been saying, including the media. In Cuba was disturbances, was disorder, and caused by the manipulation game and manipulation campaign of the U.S. government.
And when you say this manipulation campaign, could you maybe give us some more details? Because I recall there was a few years ago the U.S. tried to create a Cuban version of Twitter, which was with this exact goal of subverting the Cuban government and causing social unrest. Is that something similar that happened now?
Well, yes, it's the same game. They have always applied the same rules, the same procedure against Cuba and other countries. They want to create a reality to show the world, a reality that is not like that. And that's the result. They have, you know better than me, that who have the media have the power. And unfortunately, Cuba is a small island and the U.S. is the most powerful country in the world. And they have all the means to manipulate the media.
Do you feel that the media, not just in the United States, but in the Western world in general, so in Europe, even in Austria, do you think that they've been reporting accurately and honestly on what's happening in Cuba?
No, unfortunately not. They have not respected the principle of impartiality that any journalist must have, because I think they have limited themselves to replicate what other media said about Cuba, without verifying, without contrasting, without even inquiring or I don't know, questioning anything. They have just put the same news that they saw in other media. This is not good. I think, and I don't know if it is a cause of the lack of interest of some media or to the fear of going out the line that have been dictated to them.
I saw in The Guardian, for example, they had a crowd of people protesting, but they were holding the flag of Castro's July 26th movement,
yeah,
and they
yeah,
say
yeah,
it was anti-government.
It's really funny. It's
yeah.
really funny.
And
yeah.
there's the, even the United Nations, they use a picture of a woman who's in favor of the government. So I wanted to ask about these, like, you know, how big is, how far does this go with this image
yeah.
manipulation?
They have been in an imaginal level. Because they have used false images to say certain things, and after a few days that have been discovered that is a lie. They have used an image of a parade for the 1st of May of Cuba, of course saying that this was happening in Cuba as the protest.
They say this is the
slogan
the
protest,
that they have,
yeah.
Right?
They say that July 11th, people went out to the streets, and this is the protest, and this is the first of my parade of Cuba. They have also made collage of pictures. This is of pictures of people wounded, even children, and none of them are of Cuba, none of them are Cubans.
You see this typical hashtag, this SOS Cuba, right?
Yeah.
They keep using this.
SOS Cuba, SOS Cuba Libre, Cuba Free, it's, well.
What you're seeing happening right now in Cuba with this image manipulation, with the narratives in the media, do you feel that this is something that we've seen maybe before in Venezuela, in Syria, you know, countries that the United States doesn't like, let's put it that way.
Yeah. I think they have applied the same manual for various countries from the Middle East, from Europe, and also from Latin America. Of course, they want to do an interventionist campaign in order to achieve what they call regime change. And the pattern of lies, if used, to justify a military intervention or for encouraging chaos and disturbances and instability in a country that would lead eventually to a regime change. And that's what they have done in other countries.
You know, when it comes to what they're saying, pushing for regime change, we hear some of the loudest voices in favor of regime change. There are Cubans or Cuban exiles living in Miami. Miami is a very big hotspot for this, and these calls for regime change, increasing sanctions, bombing Cuba. Do these opinions represent the majority of Cubans living in Cuba?
No. No. This is not the image of the Cubans abroad. And I thank you very much for this question, because this is very important. I have the opportunity to clarify the people who see this interview. Well, it is true that some radical groups in Miami, especially in Miami, are asking for military interventions and calling for concrete actions against Cuba and saying messages of hate even towards their own relative in Cuba. But this is not the real image that the majority of the people abroad. I think the majority of the people abroad, the Cuban people abroad, love their homeland, love their country. Because I'm not speaking about the ideology. I'm speaking about love to your land, love to your people. And that's what I feel. And this is very important to clarify, because the media have played a very important role here. The media have tried to highlight the manifestation of hate of the Cuban people. But you can also find on internet images, videos, and messages for the other side, for the vast majority of the Cuban people, saying messages of love, strength, and solidarity. And I want to also to recognize, and this is very important, because meanwhile, a part of these radicals were making demonstrations in front of our headquarters, of the Cuban headquarters abroad, diplomatic headquarters, and saying offenses and doing vandalism acts against
our
embassy.
I saw in Paris yesterday.
Yeah. A vast majority of the other Cubans were struggling to gather medical supplies to send to Cuba. Mm. Yeah, they were doing a lot of efforts trying to send shipments to Cuba with medical supplies, and they achieved that. We have received in Cuba hundreds of shipments of medical supplies thanks to the efforts of these Cubans, of the vast majority of Cubans, with messages of love, strength, solidarity, and unity. And I think that's the image of the Cuban abroad.
When you hear not just Cubans, expatriates or exiles, but politicians, Cuban Americans, like we have Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, you know, they're calling for action, whatever that means. And you had the Miami mayor, actually, Suarez, who was saying that airstrikes should be on the table. I mean, what is your reaction when you hear things like that, that someone, another person, never mind someone who is claiming to be Cuban, is calling to bomb Cuba? What is your reaction to that?
Well, that is difficult. Because I believe that these people you mentioned, this U.S. politician, doesn't feel like Cubans. That's the answer to your question. Because any Cuban who loves its country cannot promote or call for airstrikes against your own land. And those politicians, I believe that they have a very strict line of political interest, economic interest, and also electoral interest. So they call for maintaining the distance between the U.S. And Cuba. They are also against the rebuilding of ties. I think those people are not Cubans. They don't feel like Cuban.
What's more interesting, considering these politicians in the United States, you know, some of them call themselves socialists or progressives, and yet, you know, when they talk about Cuba, they as we say, I think it's called both-siding the issue. So they say, on one hand, yes, the embargo should be lifted on Cuba. And then they also say that the government is anti-democratic. It's brutalizing the Cuban people. So they repeat the same kind of rhetoric, the same line as, you know, the people we were just talking about now previously. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, like, you know, these politicians?
I believe that those politicians in the U.S. receive a lot of pressure from others. Any politician who wants to express an opinion different from that is the vision of the government receive critics, and it's not well seen in the U.S. And saying something good about Cuba and in the U.S. it has a very high cost for a U.S. politician. That's why I couldn't somehow understand why those politicians have to, on one hand, to criticize the blockade, and the other hand to criticize Cuba to make a balance. But however, I want to recognize and also express my appreciation to those politicians that, in spite of the differences in ideology, have been brave enough as to reject and criticize the policy of sanction against Cuba. That's not an easy action in the U.S., and they have done that.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Considering the ties between the United States and Cuba, Joe Biden, when he was running for president during his campaign, he said that he would go back to the era of Obama in terms of relations with Cuba. So far, he's failed to do so. Why do you think that is?
Joe Biden has not only maintained the blockade, he has also maintained the reinforcements of the blockade with the 243 measures applied by the Trump administration, and also the 55 measures applied during the time of the pandemic. And he has even applied other sanctions last week against one official of my country and also an entity of my country. And he said that this is just a beginning. So, speaking about the reason, this is just hypothetical because I have not all the answers. But in my opinion, I believe that this behavior of Biden is a result of the very strong pressures he has been receiving from representatives of these radical groups of anti-Cubans that have been asking for concrete actions against Cuba and military intervention. And also he has this behavior is due to the electoral ambitions that Joe Biden has. Towards the Florida state.
As you have recalled, he said that this is just the beginning, which, I mean, it sounds like a threat. It's a veiled threat. I mean, do you think that there's any hope the United States will move towards reestablishing ties with Cuba or improving ties in this term, at least?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. We have time. The beginning has not been so good. Actually, has been very bad, even worse than Trump administration, because he maintained the same sanctions that Trump's and even put another one. But we have to give the benefit of the doubt to Biden. Maybe in a few months the policy change. But right now I have not hope. I have not hope because the situation has been very bad.
Speaking of the situation, Cuba is the only country in Central and Latin America who's actually been able to develop its own COVID-19 vaccine. However, as we've seen, because of the embargo, there have been ventilator shortages, syringe shortages. There's all kinds of medical equipment that Cuba's unable to access from abroad. How much has this embargo worsened the situation, even though Cuba has made huge leaps and even sent doctors to other countries to fight this?
I have to start saying that not a single family in Cuba has not been affected by the blockade. Everyone has been affected, because the blockade affects every dimension of the Cuban economy and society. And you have mentioned in your question the problems, the difficulties that Cuba has in getting supplies, medical supplies during the pandemic, and this has been as a result of the blockade. And I think that the most painful dimension of the blockade is the impact on the health situation, on the health system in Cuba. And another example of the health system, of the impact of these sanctions, is that we in Cuba are deprived from acquiring some medicines only produced in the U.S. For the treatment of cancer, for example. Yes. And this is very painful for the Cuban people, and this is very alarming also.
If we're clear that the embargo and the various other measures that the United States and its allies have taken against Cuba, they do affect the situation economically, socially. I mean, how do you respond to people who try to frame the entire situation, like all these problems, as just the government's fault? You know, they say, oh, this is socialism, and it's the government's fault. And as you mentioned, they say the embargo has nothing to do with this. I mean, what would you respond to these people?
Well, first of all, I have also to recognize that the government of Cuba is not perfect. We have the government has its defects, its deficiencies. Any other government of the world has, and we have tried to resolve those problems. Even the president of the Republic of Cuba have expressed it in several times that we have deficiencies and we have to solve it. And we are in the middle of the process of updating our system, our economic and social system, especially in order to try to solve our problems. But I can assure you that the biggest obstacle that the development of our economy has is the blockade, is the effect of the blockade. And also, if the solution to our problems depending on the internal decision, I believe that long time ago the people of Cuba would be living in much better conditions than they do right now. And unfortunately, the solution does not depend on the willingness of the government of Cuba, but on the willingness of the government of the U.S.
We see that Cuba sends doctors to a lot of countries. The United States sends soldiers to other countries, as we just talked about. They occupy other countries around the world. Where does this difference in ideology come from? Why is it that Cuba is sending missions of doctors to help other countries, and the United States sends Marines? I mean, where does this come from?
Our national hero, Jose Marti, you must have known about it. He used to say a phrase, a very known phrase in Cuba. He said that men, the human, divided into two kinds, those who love and found, and those who hate and destroy. And I think that the main difference between U.S. government and Cuba is principles. The Cuban Revolution is based on the principle of solidarity, while the government of the U.S. With neoliberal imperialism moves by interest, economic, political, and geostrategic interest, and it has no limits. It has been proved with the dropping of the nuclear bombs to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also in the multiple wars and conflicts that they have been created and financed, and which they have took benefits from.
What is the worst lie you've seen? And I know this is a big question because there's a lot, but what is the biggest piece of misinformation or mistruth or blatant lie that you've heard about Cuba, whether it's in the media or on social media?
I would like to refer to the two biggest lies I have seen. The first one is of the missed people, the disappears. Yeah, they have even circulated a list of hundreds of disappears in Cuba, and it has been proved by the government that those people are not disappeared. They even included an official, people who work in the cinema production in Cuba, and this person, when he saw his name, he said, "Well, I'm disappeared." This is unbelievable, and this is completely out of order. This is not real. In Cuba, there is not a single people missed. And the other thing was they were saying, especially in the social media, that in Cuba the government took in prison children. Yeah, this is completely also false. We have a priority to take care of children. We don't take children in prison and during the protest. This is completely wrong. And yes, there are a lot of other lies, but this is the two shocking one. Yeah.
Marlene Rodendo, thank you so much for your time. And I'm very grateful for your time for receiving us here. Thank you so much. It's really my pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It has been a huge pleasure. And thank you so much for trying to get the truth about Cuba. This is not common, and I have to congratulate you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guests, Brother Ayman Rizvi and Ali Alevian. Assalamu alaikum to both of these dear guests.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, brother. So in the series of the program, Viewpoints, we are mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei. One important topic which has been tackled by him on different occasions and his speeches is the position of human being and how important it is in Islam. We know that Islam has a type of special and specific look at the position of human being as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's why when we are talking about human, we are not talking about the humanistic approach, something which was very much welcome in the Western world or secular world. We are talking about Islam, we are talking about Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt's viewpoints regarding human beings. Imam Khamenei also, on different occasions, tackled this issue. So, Brother Ali Alevian, regarding the position of human being, we know that humans have specific needs.
Yeah.
And these needs, are usually divided into two parts. Some of them are the mundane or the physical ones, and the other ones are the spiritual ones. About the physical needs, okay, we know what are they and how to answer them. This is clear. But what about the spiritual ones? What are the spiritual needs of a human being and how to answer them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Due to this discussion on the needs of human beings in this universe, actually, there are many different kinds of needs of human, and there are many different types of human needs that we can discuss about. Some are spiritual and some are physical, some are social and some are personal, and also some of these needs are natural needs of human beings, natural in the sense of being from a fatri source. Some are not from not natural and not fatri.
Okay.
So we have to distinguish between different classes and types of, let's say, needs, and the importance of each of these needs, and to see which one or which ones have priority for human beings. Some of these spiritual needs actually need to have a sort of, let's say, material base first. So in case there are some of the material needs of human beings are not saturated, then the spiritual need will actually cannot find its materialization and its realization. But there are some needs of human beings that actually have been the same in the course of history, and they have not changed too much, like the need of, or the willing of human being towards, let's say, justice, towards spirituality, towards, let's say,
freedom. Okay.
These are the concepts that all human beings are in need of and in search of. And they have not changed drastically in the course of history. And you can ask anyone whether good or bad. So do you agree with justice? Definitely they will tell you yes. So even the worst person that we can even imagine in our minds is in need of justice, in need of, let's say, improvement, in need of
tranquility, for
tranquility,
example,
security.
Yes.
These are the needs that human beings are actually in need of.
Of course, we know that the concept of adala, that the justice that you talked about, is very much differently defined today.
Yeah, all of these concepts and in all of these, let's say, categories that I have named, they have very deep and controversial discussion on each of them.
I mean
from even starting from freedom, going to justice, and moving to spirituality. Okay. Any of these categories actually have very detailed discussion that we cannot start discussing all of them in depth.
I mean, they have both aspects too.
Yeah.
Because when we are talking about adala, when we are talking about tranquility and safety and security, both of these, I mean, all of these concepts can be defined in both terms.
Mm-hmm.
The mundane and the materialistic, the physical one, and the spiritual one too.
Yeah.
And this is what sometimes makes the game very much difficult, because the people nowadays are playing in the fields of the games of the azadi, freedom, or justice, adala, in terms of what? In terms of the materialistic ones.
Okay.
And now the spiritual one. The spiritual and the Islamic one is a very different story.
Very true. So when we go back to a sort of definition that religion, and namely Islam, gives to these concepts, it becomes different.
Okay.
So it makes them very special, and actually the kind of look that religion can, the kind of attention that religion can give to this concept is very unique for itself.
That's right.
And now, not every religion in an Islamic worldview, the look that we have towards spirituality, as you said, towards security, as we actually mentioned, they are special in themselves.
That's right.
So, security in the eyes of Islam, freedom in the eyes of Islam, let's say tranquility,
the spirituality and
akhlaq and morality, in the eyes of Islam, are different and are very beautiful to be discussed. So this is the place that actually the discussion actually differentiates with other religions and with other even definitions of these terms.
So if I agree, let's go one by one
mm-hmm.
to these needs. Sayyid Ayman Rezvi, let's start with this ma'naviyah and akhlaq. I mean, spirituality and ethics or morality. We know that akhlaq, we can say, is a specific field of study, which is even educated and trained in the Islamic houses and Islamic seminaries all across the world. How do you think that this need of human being can be answered, especially in today's world, in the 21st century, which the people are surrounded by different evil powers?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
And asking me this important question. Islamic teachings explain that a human being is a creation of two aspects, spiritual and physical. And this is exactly what is missing missing in humanism or secularism or whatever the ism we see on the European side right now. They are only paying attention to the physical aspect of human beings and mainly the desires of human beings. They think that whatever human beings desire should be fulfilled right away. And that is where we differ with them. Islam says that, you know, the spiritual part of human beings, the spiritual aspect of human being is most important than the physical aspect. Physical aspect, it's simply prerequisites.
That's
maybe
right.
You can take help from them as a tools, and then you can continue the journey of perfection for the spiritual, you know, part.
That's right.
Now, if we remember God every moment, it would affect all of our actions, and we can be in constant contact with God through the remembrance of God. But before remembrance of God comes the faith in God, which is the most important part.
Right.
Because when I was reading the Makarimul Akhlaq, the Dua Makarimul Akhlaq, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam starts with the first faraz or the climax, and he explains that, oh God, give me the akmalul iman.
Mm-hmm.
That is the first thing.
The perfect form of religion.
The perfect form
of faith.
Of the faith, exactly.
Right.
Because if we don't have the faith in God or his prophets or the process of accountability and the rest of the things,
yes. We
are incomplete.
Yes.
We cannot move forward in the right direction.
Okay.
So that's why spirituality and ethics, you know, really plays a greater role in this area.
We practice Islam every day. We do our wajibat. Sometimes we do our mustahabat and recommended actions. But for the akhlaq and the ethics, I think we need a trainer, isn't it?
It's very interesting. I was actually reading article written by a student in Hawza Ilmiya. He talked about this concept. Then, you know, in Hawza, when we come to the Hawza, we learn that there are the this list, you know, the tartib is like this.
Yes.
For example, first comes aqaid,
yes,
and then akhlaq, and then ahkam, right?
Mm.
So this is the one part of the ulama,
yes,
explains this. But the second part of ulama says that in some juziyat or some parts, akhlaq comes first,
mm-hmm,
and then aqaid, and then ahkam. Yeah.
Yes.
And in this part of ulama, we have Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi,
yes,
and also Allama Hilli.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that their example was a juzi example, the partial example was that every human being is looking, to thank a person who has given a gift to him.
Okay.
Every single being,
yes,
right? So when we look around us, we see this whole universe. So why should not we thank the creator of this,
yes,
universe?
Yes, why not?
So this,
mm-hmm,
you know, this is the starting place. And I think this is what missing from our societies, that
mm-hmm,
we don't pay enough attention to akhlaq.
Yes.
We are only paying attention to ahkam.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the problem.
Very good. Brother Ali Alevian, what's your take on that? We pay attention to, ahkam and aqaid. I mean, the rulings, which are considered about what is halal, what is haram, how to do wajibat, okay? What are the beliefs in our system? But what about the akhlaqi part of the life of the human beings?
Yeah, actually, spiritualities have an important role in our lives, and we cannot actually ignore their role in life. In case we delete and remove and omit spirituality from our life, so nothing will exist from our, from our personality and a human being's personality, because human being is in need of a sort of, supplication, prayer with the creator.
That's right.
So Where are they discussed? They are discussed in actually akhlaqi sessions, akhlaqi meetings, and human beings are always in need of a person to guide them and advise them. It is famous that the Holy Prophet,
he didn't want to deprive himself out of the counsel or consultation of the people around, especially the companions.
Look,